This program is a paid commercial announcement from Jacob Media Partners and does not reflect the views of WPHT or its management.
Free speech lives here. Talk Radio 1210. WPHT. WPHT HD. WOGL HD3. Philadelphia. Welcome to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network, your hometown legal experts. From the courtroom to the boardroom, get educated on the law from some of the most powerful attorneys in the Delaware Valley. Welcome to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network. Here's Jay Dock and Joe Kraus.
Busy Sunday afternoon here in the Delaware Valley, and we welcome everyone in to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. We are live on this Sunday, and we welcome everybody in for the next 60 minutes. Got a great conversation with our special co-host today, attorney Jeff Gross. So nice to get Jeff back on the show and into the conversation. Let me bring J-Doc into the conversation first and welcome you into the show as well. J-Doc, how are you, sir?
I'm great, Joe. I'm really looking forward to today's show. It's been a while that we've had Jeff at the helm, and certainly lots going on around the Delaware Valley and across the land. And certainly we have some great legal discussion coming our way. And we got a great guest. Jeff's got a great guest. So lots to talk about, my friend.
Good stuff, J-Doc, with that introduction from the law firm of Gross & Kenny. Jeff Gross joins us here on this Sunday in the Delaware Valley. Jeff, a good Sunday evening to you, man. So nice to have you back with the headset on the microphone back here on the Lawyer to Lawyer Network.
Glad to be here, Joe. Thanks for having me. Always a great time.
Yeah, no doubt about it. A lot of information evolves during our 60-minute conversation. Jeff, you have a great guest coming up. We'll bring your guest into the conversation on the other side of our opening break. But let me give you an opportunity to set the table for the listening audience on your agenda today, what we're going to talk about from a legal perspective. Let's start there, and then we'll pick it up.
Sure. I thought it would be a good idea to bring in a discussion about settlements. I think a lot of people are always interested in settlements. Settlements are the kingpin of and the culmination of a lawsuit or a workers' compensation claim. And what better than to bring in a settlement discussion involving both the intersection of a workers' compensation claim as well as a third-party claim. And I think this would be a good opportunity for that.
You know, the tagline underneath that word settlement is the process. Or that's not even a tagline, that's just the word. But the process to get to the settlement sometimes can be a long road, an uneasy road, a nerving road for somebody who has been injured in the workplace, somebody who is entitled to workers' compensation. It's not where you start, it's where you end, but sometimes that's a cloudy process, Jeff.
It's an extremely cloudy process, and it's a long process as well. And the hardest thing to do is to make sure that my clients are comfortable during the time period. It's not easy. It's not emotionally easy. It's not physically easy, actually, to get through this process. But we managed to do it, and we managed to do it well. And at the end of the day, everybody's much better for it. And I think that this is a perfect opportunity to bring in a discussion of that process, just like you said, and how we achieve what we're trying to achieve.
You know, it's amazing, Jeff, because what we're going to do when we bring your guest in is we're going to, like you said, talk about the process between a workers' comp attorney and a workers' comp situation and a personal injury and that settlement process. But when it comes to a workers' comp case individually, what makes it so interesting is, the different ways in regards to the types of settlements. For example, what a workers' compensation case typically speaking, a loan, you can do a settlement, but in many cases, you're not suing your employer, whereas you have a personal injury attorney and they're dealing with negligence, and they, you know, they do bring the lawsuit up. This is a case where you bring them all together. Before we go, you know, to break, talk about the fact that in workers' comp alone, it doesn't have to be a negligent situation in order for somebody to be eligible for workers' compensation and at the same time, you know, acquire a settlement that way.
That's absolutely correct. It's a very convoluted process, and different scenarios, different fact scenarios involve different procedures. For instance, as you just correctly pointed out, you can have a workers' compensation claim without a third-party claim. For our audience and our listeners today, a third-party claim is a claim involving someone other than the workers' compensation insurance company, someone other than your employer. Under the law in Pennsylvania and in every single state in the country, you can't sue your employer for negligence. So if you're lifting something at work and you pull out your lower back, you're not going to have a third-party claim. You're going to just have a workers' comp claim because there is no one to blame for pulling out your lower back other than the fact that you hurt yourself in the process of working. And that would be, as you pointed out, a lone workers' compensation claim. You would only have a workers' compensation claim. And workers' compensation gives you two things. It gives you wage loss benefits for the duration of your disability, and it gives you medical benefits as long as you need it as a result of that work accident. And so when you make a settlement, which could be a couple of months, a couple of years, or it could be a long time, depending on how well you achieve a recovery or you don't achieve a recovery and you reach what we call maximum medical improvement, that process is alone mine to deal with. And I handle that, and I either keep the individual worker on workers' compensation or I end up making a lump sum settlement down the road. When you involve the concept of negligence, and workers' compensation is a no-fault act, it doesn't require you to prove negligence. But when you involve the concept of negligence, meaning the fault of someone that is not your employer, then you can have a combination work-related injury claim, a workers' compensation claim, and you can also have a third-party claim, a claim against the person or the entity that caused the accident. So to give you an example of that, let's suppose, I don't know, let's say you are a delivery of dog collars, and you have a delivery to make, and you're on the highway, and you're on en route to make your delivery working for this dog collar company, and let's suppose that you get struck from behind by a tractor trailer who crests a hill on the interstate, not seeing you stopped in traffic, and causes catastrophic injuries to you. Then you would have a workers' compensation claim against the dog collar company, and you would have a third-party claim against the Mack truck or the Amazon truck or whoever struck you from behind as a result of their negligence in cresting the hill without taking into consideration what might be on the other side, i.e. stopped traffic. And so there you would have a two-part claim, a work-related injury claim, a workers' compensation claim, as well as a third-party claim against the Amazon truck or whatever truck struck you. And that's where the intersection of workers' compensation and third-party negligence claims exists. And that's what I'd like to talk about today with my special guest.
We're going to get to a commercial break here. Jeff, just quickly, one last question for clarity. If you sustain an injury on the job that is catastrophic, meaning you are not able to ever return back to that job, does workers' compensation provide you, or are you entitled to workers' compensation forever or for an extended period because you can never go back to work?
And before you answer that question, Jeff, add this little component to it. If you sustain that catastrophic injury on the job, and it's your fault. It wasn't somebody else's. You accidentally hit the wrong button and went down. Are you still eligible for workers' compensation? And Joe Krause's question, are you entitled to it forever?
All right, great questions, guys. The answer to your question is, number one, Pennsylvania's Workers' Compensation Act is a no-fault act, meaning it doesn't matter whose fault it is. It could be my fault, your fault, somebody else's fault, or nobody's fault. If it's your fault and you're the driver of the vehicle and you sustain a one-car collision, let's just say, and or you cause an accident, but maybe it's even your fault, you can still collect workers' compensation. And the most interesting thing is, as Joe pointed out, how long can you get workers' compensation? The answer is indefinitely. There's a lot of rumors that you can get it for 10 years, or you can get it for 2 years, or you can get into your 65. The answer is that's all false. You can get workers' compensation benefits for the duration of your disability. And if your disability lasts your entire life, well, you can get workers' compensation for your entire life.
Attorney Jeff Gross with us on the Lawyer to Lawyer Network. We'll get to a commercial break on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Back in a moment.
This is the Lawyer to Lawyer Network.
Back here live on a Sunday night on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Welcome in, everyone, to Lawyer Network. Attorney Jeff Gross from the law firm of Gross and Kenny guiding the ship today. We're here until 6 o'clock. PhillaWorkersComp.com is the email address. If you want to check into that email, you'll find a lot of great information and you'll find contact information for our co-host Jeff Gross. A lot of good information, and we're going to give you a lot of good information on this show, J-Doc, so I thank you for being here as well.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, one of the great parts about the Lawyer to Lawyer Network is that we get the opportunity to meet, you know, some of the outstanding attorneys and have great hosts like Jeff Gross and also great guests. And one of the individual that I'm going to introduce right now, really from a cutting edge firm, a personal injury firm that, you know, it's really an all-star firm, that formed during the pandemic of longtime successful attorneys, you know, at the highest level. That came together to sort of start, in my opinion, almost like a super firm they got going there, and it's an amazing job they do on behalf of their clients. So I'm going to bring into the program Joshua Van Arden, who's a co-founding partner at VSCP Law. Joshua, how are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks a lot, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. I had the pleasure of having Ryan Chase the other day, your partner, and Greg Spicer before that. And I know we got one partner left. We're going to save him for the next show. But it's great to have. If you would tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the firm, and also, you know, before we get into the conversation, because we got a great topic that we're going to talk about, you know, the four of you coming together in the midst of the pandemic, and not only starting, you know, a super firm, but also, you know, hitting the ground running and doing a fantastic job for your clients.
Sure. I'm born and raised in a suburb outside of Northeast Philadelphia, and I've pretty much stayed local. My first job out of law school, I was an assistant district attorney here in Philadelphia under Lynn Abraham. Got a lot of great trial experience before I left, and then I ended up going for a short bit of time to a very prestigious catastrophic loss plaintiffs firm, and then for the last 16, 17 years been at another very high-end plaintiffs firm, and got a lot of great experience trying a lot of these catastrophic cases, meeting some great people who have unfortunately suffered devastating losses. And, you know, about six to eight months ago, two other individuals at my previous firm who were also partners, we decided that we could bring our talents and expertise and start our own firm. We were blessed in that it just kind of dovetailed with Greg Spicer, who was also a shareholder and partner at another very, very well-known plaintiff's firm in the city. And, you know, we decided that even though, you know, we're kind of in the midst of a pandemic, we can put together a team and with an eye towards, you know, really using some of the technologies available to firms right now that enable us to really maximize what we do. And it really didn't hinder us at all. Going and starting this new venture, even though it was in a pandemic, because of that, we've really been able to connect with our clients without missing a beat. So it's great.
So having said that, what's exciting about the interview we have right now is obviously Jeff Gross is our host on the broadcast. Jeff is one of the premier workers' compensation attorneys in the city of Philadelphia, and he represents injured workers. And, of course, you represent individuals also that suffer third-party case injuries, construction, or workplace from a negligence standpoint. And so, Jeff, first of all, I want to, bring you in to say hello to Josh, and then of course talk about the primary topic of the show today, which is going to be, like we touched on earlier, settlements involving both workers' compensation and third party claims, and maximizing the value of them. Jeff Gross.
Thank you, Joe. Josh, it's a privilege and an honor to have you on the show today. I'm very familiar with your firm and the principals in that firm, and you do a hell of a job, and I'm really proud to have you here. And so what we were discussing was the intersection between a claim that involves both workers' compensation as well as a third-party claim. And, of course, you would come in on the third-party element of the claim, meaning the negligence of another party other than the employer in as a result of a work accident. And what we were discussing was the process by which we bring the claim and how it is devised among the two aspects of the claim, both the comp and the third party, and how that is achieved and how we can maximize the potential for both. And so what I was going to explain was that, when we have a work-related injury, there's a process and a procedure to handling the workers' compensation claim, devising the claim, making sure that the correct description of injury is accepted by the carrier, making sure the appropriate wage rate is established. And then once that's done, we build that claim such that the third-party aspect of the claim can be maximized by a concept called subrogation, which is a dirty word in the law business, but essentially for our listeners, it involves the workers' compensation carrier being allowed to get back, so to speak, through a process of subrogation, the amount of money it's spent on both the wage loss and the medical component of the work injury payout. When the third-party claim, the negligence claim, is perfected and awarded against that third-party entity. And, Josh, that would be your expertise. And so welcome to the program. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you go about fielding a claim from us where we would refer the case to you after a work-related injury is ensued such that you can – then establish the third-party negligence claim.
Sure. It's so important for these individuals to have, a very high-end, experienced workers' comp lawyer like yourself, Jeff, in order to navigate them through those issues because they can be tricky. And it's also important to have somebody who is pursuing those workers' compensation claims who understands the concept of like being part of a team, and even though, you know, we may not be from the same firm, we have to work hand in hand because what you do on your end increases value for the case that I may be handling, even though the claims are different. And I don't pretend to understand all of the aspects of workers' comp, but, you know, the pain and the suffering, which tend to be big ticket items on the third party claim are not something that you get compensated for on the comp claim. And we then, you know, work in connection with the comp carrier to get obviously all of the medical records that the clients that you have obtained on behalf of the client, all of the independent medical examinations and evaluations that have been done over time to make sure that when we pursue our third party claim, it's all very consistent. But, you know, it's because of the type of cases that our firm handles and because we are really limited to catastrophic loss, catastrophic injury, the majority of these individuals are never going back to work. And I know that, and I'm sure that a lot of the comp cases that you handle are more nuanced than that, in that maybe some people can go back to work in some capacity. But because the population of clients that we tend to represent are totally and permanently disabled, you know, there can be a lot of records and significant evaluations that will help to substantiate the damages on our end. But even more so than that, there may have been an OSHA investigation. There may have been interviews with different workers related to the work injury that we need access to in order to also help our negligence claim. So it's really a symbiotic relationship, because obviously, Jeff, you have an interest in ensuring that the subrogation claim obviously is preserved, because they're entitled to be repaid. And if they want to be repaid, traditionally, there should be this kind of relationship where you're helping us, so that at the end of the day, when we settle and resolve the third party claim, number one, it helps us because we get to say to the responsible party that we are prosecuting, you have to at least pay back X, whatever that lien is. And that's like almost the floor to establishing value for those cases. And then obviously making sure that at the end of the resolution, that gets paid back. So it's really a symbiotic relationship across the board.
I totally agree with that. Josh, you hit the nail right on the head, and you explained it very, very well to our listeners. Some of our listeners might be thinking to themselves, well, what happens? What is the procedure, actually? How do we recover one versus the other? Which is the first recovery? Which is the second recovery? How does that work? And the answer is that the workers' compensation claim would be the first to proceed, because that is the establishment of the disability in and of itself, along with the treatment for the work-related accident and the injuries that ensue. And so what ends up happening is we would bring that workers' comp claim, and we would maximize the recovery on that issue, whether it's to establish a person on benefits for an ongoing claim, such that that person receives a benefit check every week or 2 weeks, indefinitely, or whether we make a lump sum settlement down the road. That would be the way in which we would establish the claim, and then we would build that claim. Because of the statute of limitations, which is 2 years in Pennsylvania, then Josh would step in, and he would then file a lawsuit against the third-party entity responsible for the accident, and that would then ensue. In an ideal world, the workers' compensation claim would settle on or before the third-party claim gets finished, because that would maximize the value of the third-party claim. And the reason that that's the case is because the workers' compensation money that gets paid out is allowable. You're allowed to have that those figures displayed for a jury to see. So when a jury sees that a certain amount of money is paid out for medical and a certain amount of money is paid out for wage loss, the totality of that payment would be admissible in evidence, so that the jury could see what that amount is. And then on top of that, Josh would be able to get the non-economic damage element paid, which would be the pain, the suffering, the loss of life's pleasures, and the whole laundry list of different items that are non-economic damages, damages that we can't really calculate. And so in order to get to that number, the way to make that number much larger is to maximize what's been paid out by the workers' compensation insurance carrier. And then in a perfect world, both of the claims would settle at the same time, or the workers' comp settlement would be just prior to the third party claim. That's not always the case, though, and so that's when we have to be creative in how we deal with things.
Lawyer to Lawyer Network here on a Sunday night on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT, two powerhouse attorneys educating you tonight. We are live. We'll get to a commercial break. We'll continue the conversation on the other side with attorney Jeff Gross and attorney Joshua Van Arden back in a moment.
Now back to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network.
And so glad to be live with you here on a Sunday night on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. If you're listening in on Talk Radio 1210 as you drive home or drive back to the Delaware Valley from spending the weekend down at the Jersey Shore, keep your eye on the road, but keep your ear, J-Doc, right to the dial. Good conversation with attorney Jeff Gross tonight.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff and attorney Joshua Van Arden are talking, settlements involving both work comp and third-party claims and maximizing the value of them. And so the last part of that sentence was maximizing the value of them. And I'd like to segue to Josh Van Arden and ask about how you value, and then we'll segue to Jeff in regards to workers' comp, but how you value, because I'm sure you get somebody will walk into the office, and you're dealing with catastrophic injuries, so there's a chance they may not be walking into the office, but maybe a family member would be, but eventually somebody's going to ask you, how much is my case worth? And you have had, and we've done some research, and multi-million dollar cases that were catastrophic injuries. I think it was one case, which was the highest of 2019. But that's got to be a question, one of the first questions on at least a family member's mind. How do you value a case, a catastrophic injury case that comes across your table? Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. It's a great question, Joe, because we do get that question a lot. And the obvious response is, well, it depends. It depends on a variety of different things. Number one, obviously, the strength of the individual claim itself. How egregious is the negligence? If the negligence is particularly egregious, it drives the value of the case up because juries get upset and they get mad. So that's one issue. The second issue is what we like to call like the hard numbers. Was the person a worker? How much did they make? How old are they? How much more time would they have had in the workforce moving forward that they're no longer able to do because of their injury? And again, we're talking in the context of somebody who maybe is permanently and significantly disabled, totally disabled, as opposed to maybe death claims, which we also handle as well. And then moving forward, well, does this person need future medical care and how much future medical care and what that will cost? And a lot of that is done, on Jeff's end in the evaluation and resolution of the comp claim. But then becomes the hard task and the task of maximizing the things that we can't put necessarily a dollar amount on without knowing more about who that person was. Pain and suffering, or who that person is, all of the recoverable damages under Pennsylvania law, loss of life's pleasures, disfigurement, embarrassment, all of those things play a very significant part in maximizing recovery. And that really depends on the person themselves. You know, I've tried cases where I've had very significant verdicts and only had the plaintiff on the witness stand for maybe 10, 15 minutes. So it's not about just like putting somebody on the witness stand and having them, complain about what their day is like, but really
breaking it down to its core about how that has affected that person and their family, and connecting with a jury so that they themselves can truly understand what it's like. Because ultimately, we can give numbers to a jury to represent lost wages. We can give them numbers as guidance regarding future medical care. But we can't give them any guidance regarding those non-concrete numbers like pain and suffering and loss of life's pleasures. They just listen to the plaintiff. They listen to the plaintiff's family. And they have to judge based on their life experiences and their common sense what that's worth. That's why when families come in to see us and they want to know what their case is worth, we say, well, it really does depend. Because, you know, people who get on a witness stand and are like, yeah, it really stinks. And that's it. No jury's going to give them any money for that,
right.
Because they don't truly understand what it's like. But working with clients, then that goes in, like when they go into their deposition and they get deposed, but also at trial. So they one of the things I like to say to my clients is, like, you're going to walk into a room with 12 people that don't know you from Adam. They have no idea what your life's journey is. They have no idea what it is to be disabled. They may not even have, like, you know, ancillary experiences with the kind of pain that you're dealing with every day. So you got to explain it to them. You got to bring them into your world, because ultimately, if the verdict is, or the settlement is lower, that's probably why. It's because you weren't able to articulate it. And sometimes, look, we have experts who take the witness stand, experts in pain and suffering. I know, previously on the show, you've had individuals specialize in that to talk to juries about what that's like. But that's important too. But it's also very important for the clients to be able to articulate that. And that's kind of what we do. That's one of our specialties, is working with clients to get them to a point where they can adequately communicate to somebody who doesn't know what it's like to be them, so that they can place a value on it. And that's, by the way, that's the difference when you see verdicts that run the gamut of, like, oh, lower verdicts, you know, moderate verdicts, or very high verdicts. Ultimately, it speaks to, I think, the quality of the preparation going into a deposition or a trial. It really does change the value of these cases.
Jeff Gross?
Totally agree. And the only way to effectively make a case worth more money is the art of communication, and being able to communicate to a jury exactly what the problems are and what the damages that ensue the accident would be. And so these things are not easily done. Many people think that it's very easy. You simply put the guy on the stand and he talks about what the problems are that he has faced as a result of the accident, and you're finished. That's not nearly doesn't even scratch the surface of what needs to be done. You have to have adequate medical expert witnesses, and you have to have good fact witnesses that can explain what happened. But the attorney's role to be able to communicate to a jury is so significant that it needs to be discussed in the topic in and of itself. And I call that emotional intelligence. If an attorney has a high degree of emotional intelligence, then that allows for effective communication to anybody that's listening, whether it's a jury, whether it's a judge, it doesn't really matter, but you have to be able to communicate. And that's what Josh does very well. He's an excellent communicator, as you can hear and hear him discuss today. And what my role would be as the workers' compensation attorney in getting all this put together is to make sure that the medical experts are well deposed, to make sure that my clients have testified properly and in a fashion that best outlines the problems that they're facing, so that Josh can take the ball and run with it when I pass it to him. And that is what he's good at. And between the two of us, we make an excellent team.
Jeff, let me ask you to weigh in, and then Josh certainly could weigh in as well. I'm listening to the description of an individual who was injured and then at some point needs to be able to convey the story to the jury. So as Josh put it, so the jury knows and understands what your story really is. If an individual is not a great communicator or freezes in a situation when they're on the stand, does that put them in the moment at a disadvantage or no?
It puts them in the moment in a disadvantage if you leave it be like that. But if you cultivate that and use that to your benefit, you will see that most people in the world are similarly situated to that. Most people are not public speakers. Therefore, they do not tell stories, and they're not used to telling stories to juries or to judges. And so that's our role as lawyers, is to help them to effectively relate their stories. And I will tell you that the hardest part is when they are unable to communicate at all, such that if they have a head injury or if they are not present at trial because they can't be there due to their work-related injury or non-work-related injury. If you have an individual that is so concussed or has a closed head injury to the point that they can't communicate at all, then they're not going to be the ones that communicate to the jury or to the judge. You're going to have family members. You're going to have people who have taken care of this person communicate. And that is an art in and of itself. And the ability to be able to muster what I call the circus, because that's what we're really doing, right? We're putting on a circus act in order to be able to achieve what we need. We have to have experts and witnesses that are designed to deliver a story. And it has to be done in such a way that the process of delivery of that story is conducive to the person who's listening to it. They have to perceive it and understand it in a logical, chronological manner so that it can be effectively communicated and then awarded a proper verdict.
And having said that, everybody's heard, and I'm sure, Josh, this has been a nightmare for all personal injury attorneys. The old McDonald's cup of coffee settlement where it fell on somebody's lap and they got, I don't know how many millions of dollars it was. And so people come into the office, and I mean, just even on job sites, talking about that particular thing. How many times did you ever hear that? And it's mind-boggling how something like that happens, and yet somebody loses a leg, and they're it's not quite as cut and dry.
Yeah, I would say first of all, I wholeheartedly agree with what Jeff was saying regarding like how we have to work around communicating injuries to juries, because it's not as simple as putting a plaintiff on the witness stand and asking them like, so how has this affected you? Because a lot of our clients don't have inherently that emotional intelligence to be able to convey that to somebody. But that's not, this is not their forum. This is our forum. And it's our job to be able to work with that client to the extent we can to be able to elicit that information. And sometimes you have to get a little unorthodox with the way you present it. And to Jeff's point, there are some circumstances. I mean, we handle a lot of death cases where the person's no longer with us. So the people who have to carry the torch to be able to paint a picture of who that person is are the individuals that are left behind. I can give you like three different examples of times where, I really wrestled with issues related to damages to be able to convey it to the jury in non-orthodox situations. So I had a death case involving a young guy who died. He died as a result of a stroke, and his wife and he had a 12-year-old boy that I wasn't sure could make it through a trial. I mean, it's a young kid, and also I really take to heart, and we really wrestle with, like, I don't want to traumatize the boy. I don't want to. I mean, and ultimately, you think about the jury too. Is the jury going to perceive it poorly that we're putting through this this kid through a trial? But he's a beneficiary of the estate. He has a right to give his two cents about who his father was. And ultimately, he made the choice. He said, no, I absolutely want to tell this jury who my father was. He got on the witness stand, and he froze. And he's a sweet little 12-year-old boy. And so, you know, you have to really maneuver on the spot, because the last thing you want to do is just put him on the witness stand. He freezes and you're done. You know,
right.
That doesn't benefit the client. It doesn't benefit your case. So I asked him one question, and I knew this going into it because you live with these families for years. But he had a very unique haircut. And I remember sitting down with him at one of our first sessions, and I had said to him, hey, I like your hairdo. And he said to me, well, that's how my dad wore it. And when he shut down, I just turned to him and I said, hey, I said, you doing okay? He's like, yeah, I'm okay. He was very shy. I said, that's a sweet haircut. And he said, that's how my dad wore it. And he started crying. The jury was crying. The judge was crying. And honestly, that was the last. I mean, I may have asked him a few more questions, but that was really it. And it spoke volumes because, you know, this little boy who lost his father, what I wanted to convey to that jury was what his dad meant to him. And like 6 years after his dad passed away, he's still wearing the same haircut, you know?
Yeah.
So it speaks to how quickly you have to adapt in those situations with witnesses who can't properly convey it through no fault of their own. Similar to like stroke cases where the person like can't even talk anymore. You know, you have to figure a workaround. But Joe, to your question about the hot coffee kind of issue, I'll be honest with you. I have not really come across that issue because I think that once you like show the jury how serious your case is and how devastating the damages are, not just to the person but to their family, like that's I don't worry about it because
I only say that because Joe Krause has been throwing hot coffee on himself ever since. it's unnecessary, Joe. See, I just told you.
Gentlemen, on that transition from J-Doc, stay right there. We'll take a short 90-second break. This is the Lawyer to Lawyer Network.
This is the Lawyer to Lawyer Network.
Back here live on a Sunday night, J-Doc. 8 minutes until we say goodbye, but a great conversation with attorney Jeff Gross and also attorney Joshua Van Narden. Coming to an end, sadly, but good information, sir.
I mean, unbelievable. Just incredible dialogue. So insightful and emotional, even Josh, with the comment about the haircut, just insightful. One of the things that, you know, as we wind the broadcast down, wanted to ask you both about settlement offers. Somebody gets injured. You've been dealing with this situation. We've been talking about court a lot and that, but a lot of times you'll get an offer. Sometimes that offer can sound huge, but it could be somewhat of a game changer. But you may know that it's not, it's not a viable offer, or maybe it is a viable offer and the client doesn't want to accept it. I'll go to Jeff Gross first, and then we'll segue to Josh. But talk about that process because you have somebody's life in at least their financial existence in your hands. How do you deal with it?
That's a very good question. The art of negotiation is something that is a topic in and of itself, and that's certainly a good offshoot topic to discussions about settlements. But when there is a settlement offer, it's generally not the final offer. When we get a settlement offer, we know generally what the value of the claim is. No claim is worth a particular number. Most claims are worth a range of numbers. Depending on different factors, there's a low range, and there's a medium range, and there's a high range. And when I get a settlement offer based upon my evaluation of the claim for the past 31 years that I've been doing this, I'm able to discern whether that settlement offer is on the low end, the medium range, or the high end. And a lot of times it's not even in the ballpark. It's so low. But I generally do not react quickly to settlement offers because they have to be contemplated, thought about, processed. My client has to be communicated about what the range, the appropriateness is of a settlement in that particular case. And then we have to discuss where that offer fits into the scheme of things and whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. I generally make sure that I prepare my clients so that they have a certain expectation of where we're going with this range so that when a settlement offer comes in, they're already prepared as to whether that number is a good or bad. And I tell them my opinion. I tell them whether I believe that number should be accepted or should not be accepted. And I defer to my clients to make the ultimate decision because it is their case. It is not my case. A lot of times we have a situation where their expectation is different from what the actual value would be. And in those cases, it might take a lot of discussion, repeated education to be able to explain to the clients what the appropriate value would be vis-a-vis the offer. And then we decide together that whether we should accept ultimately a final offer or whether we should let a judge decide on the comp element of the settlement.
Josh, talk about your position when something like that happens.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, every case is different. I think that the responsibility that we as lawyers have to create a fund of money that will compensate somebody for the rest of their life when they certainly need it, or to compensate them for a loved one who has died is a very significant responsibility. And I can tell you, I know Jeff will agree, it keeps me up at night. And it drives me and our firm to work very hard for these individuals. But that being said, you know, the moving forward with the negotiations, it really depends on where it is in the litigation. I would say in our world, it's very rare that these cases settle early. And sometimes you have to, you know, throw them around a little bit in order to shake them and set them straight. I can give you, I'll give you a quick example of, you know, how I kind of handle it. I had a case in an unfavorable county. It was up in Cumberland County, which is a very nice place to be, but it's for a plaintiff. It's not, you know, historically the best place to be. And I had, I was representing a former police officer who had developed a quad equina syndrome, which essentially left him paralyzed. And we got there, and there was a pre-trial offer that I perceived as being low. And you know, he's from Cumberland County, and he looked at the number and said, "You know what? I think this is a good number. I think we should take it." And I said, "Trust me, there's more money there, and so I'll do whatever you want. Obviously, you drive the ship, but my recommendation would be to reject it." He rejected it. The judge colloquied him. I don't know if you've ever had that before, but the judge basically colloquied him and said, do you understand the significance of the offer?" He said, "I do, and I defer to my attorney." The trial proceeded, and you know, just things work out well sometimes, and the trial proceeded as I thought it would, and it got exponentially worse for the defendants until at the time that I closed my case, the offer had now been four times as much. But I still knew, right, knew there was more money. And so, you know, I closed my case. They offered this significantly more amount of money. And I said to my client, "Do you trust me?" He said, "Yes." I said, "There's more money there." So, like, as a lawyer, I cannot in good conscience leave money on the table if I know I can get more. Judge pulled me back and said, are you crazy? Like, we've never had a verdict or settlement above this amount. And this is above that amount, and you're not going to take it? And I said, "Judge, why would I take it if I know I can get more? That's not doing what's right by my client." And then the day of closing, they ended up tendering all of the money they had to give. And I felt really good about it. The client was obviously ecstatic. And, you know, that's a scenario where, you know, I believed in the client, I believed in the claims, and I knew no matter where I wasn't going to accept anything less than what I believed to be their bottom dollar. And sometimes you have to do that, you know.
I mean, that's incredible. That brings us to the close, man. Josh, real quick, contact information at the firm.
Sure. We are located in Two Commerce, which is 2001 Market Street, Suite 3700. You can give us a call. It's VSCP Law, Van Arden, Spicer, Chase, Pinto. Our main number is 215-960-0000. Or you can visit us on the web at www.vscplaw.com.
And Jeff Gross?
We are at 1500 JFK Boulevard in Philadelphia, Suite 1450. But the best place to get me is directly on my cell phone, 215-512-1500.
That's going to do it for this edition of the Lawyer to Lawyer Network. Special thanks to our co-host, attorney Jeff Gross, and also his special guest, attorney Joshua Van Arden. As we say goodbye to you on this Sunday night, on behalf of Jeff, Joshua, and my partner, J-Doc, and of course, Sean back at the studio producing, I'm Joe Krause. See you next time, everybody. Listening to the Lawyer to Lawyer Network. This is Joe Krause of Jacob Media. Don't be afraid to reach out to one of our powerful attorneys if you have a question or need that requires clarification. The Lawyer to Lawyer Network was created for you, the people of the Delaware Valley, to protect your rights while providing your peace of mind. The Lawyer to Lawyer Network, bringing together the most powerful attorneys from around the Delaware Valley.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.